City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Well, there you go. Who'd ever believe that you'd be listening to Dino on your iPod? Have you got your earphones well and truly down those lug holes? We're going to be looking back at some of the best bits from The Sullivan Show from the past week. Jenny Marsden's talking to me exclusively about that fantastic keyboard. He's a Freeman of the City. I'm going to be arguing my point with Councillor Flo Lucas over to our lollipop men and women. What was she talking about anyway? John Bishop had me belly laughing over George Bush's gaffes. We'll be hearing a few of those. And singing sensation Barbara Dixon spoke to me exclusively on City Talk 105.9 ahead of her gig. She's coming to Liverpool in the not too distant future, and I get a lesson in the Queen's English from our etiquette expert. Not that I need one, of course. There you go. That's all coming up on the iPod broadcast. Dino's download. Thanks for downloading me. Don't forget, I'm with you every Monday to Friday here on City Talk 105.9 with The Sullivan Show from 1 o'clock. So sit back, get your feet up, enjoy yourself, and listen to Dino's download.
The Sullivan Show.
Weekday afternoons, 1 till 4.
On City Talk 105.9.
My special guest in the cafe, Freeman of Liverpool, to be made, Freeman of Liverpool, Jerry Martin. Listen, long overdue, this award.
Golly, I don't know about that. I'm very proud I got it. I don't know if it's long overdue, but very, very pleased.
It's great. Well, it's a great honour, isn't it, of course? Because how many, if you don't mind me asking, Jerry, how many years have you been in the business?
My first show with the Beer Man, I was 15.
Right.
So you're talking 51 years.
So you've celebrated more than 50 years in the business.
Yes, I have, love.
Fantastic. You must have seen some massive changes over the years, have you?
Seen lots of changes, but the nice thing is the business, as you know, excuse me, is still the same. Great, great fun to do. I love it. I love to entertain. Like yourself, we're going to stay in there till we die.
Of course. Now, Jerry, of course, you play all over the world, don't you? It's not just in this country.
Yeah, no, we do Australia, and then we do the States, and we've done Singapore, Hong Kong. Yeah, everywhere. In my career, I think the only place I haven't played, thank God, is Afghanistan.
Right. Well, there's still time.
I'm not going.
There's still time. We'll have a word with Gordon Brown. He'll get you out there.
Oh,
and why do you think you know, your music and yourself is still popular today? I'm not saying, you know, there's any reason why you wouldn't be, but there must be something enduring about that music.
The beauty of it, Dean, was it was very simple. Simplicity. Simple songs, simple melodies, simple lyrics, and the kids could sing along, and us who were singing it, we were simple as well, so it didn't matter, but all the kids could join in, sing along, and they remember even to this day, you know, when we do the concerts, I could really walk on stage, start to sing How Do You Do It, and leave the rest to them, because
yeah.
They sing along, they have a laugh. It's just very, very simple, Dean, that's all it was.
And do you think, Jerry, that the audiences then have just stuck with you over the years?
Yes.
They've grown up with you as well.
Luckily, they've come along with me to the shows. But their kids come now. The kids of their kids come because they play the music still. They want to see the bands who do it. And after the show, when I'm signing autographs, I say, did your mum and dad drag you along? No, we wanted to see who made the records and we love it. And so it's great. It's a nice bonus to have the kids' kids are coming now.
Excellent. And, of course, you are part of that very rich, you know, musical history that came out of Liverpool, came out of Merseyside, didn't it?
Hope so.
What was it like back in those days, starting out, Jerry?
Very heady. Oh, we started out with hard graft.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't really know what was happening. Brian Epstein made the whole thing change when we came back from Germany. Brian had just signed the Beatles, and he said, Jerry, I'll manage you. And I knew Brian as a record seller, not as a manager. And I said, OK, Brian, and that just meant giving him the diary, and he'd get an extra £5 a night. And that's how it started, and then suddenly we had the records, and bloody hell, what's all this, number one records? Just four kids from Liverpool. And then it was just hectic, all over the world, crazy, as I say, the States, Singapore, Hong Kong, everywhere you did, and everybody knew the songs, and it was very, very hard work, but we were young, we were kids, we could handle it.
My special guest in the cafe, Freeman of Liverpool, to be made, Freeman of Liverpool, Jerry Marsden. Jerry, you mentioned Brian Epstein there. What was he like as a manager? What was he like as a guy? Was he quite quiet?
Brian was very... He was a great guy. Lovely chatter, very charismatic, if that's the word. He had a great... even Prince Margaret would bow to him. He was amazing. He just had this thing about him. His charisma was wonderful. And as a manager to us, he was okay. He could have done more, but they had the four best teams in the world. So, you know, he said to me, yeah, if you want to go to another stable, I can organise it. And I said, Brian, no, we're staying with you. But, you know, and he was just a very, very nice man.
And what sort of things did he used to do? Did he actually mould your career as a group and yourself, yeah?
He told us to wear suits on stage and what type songs to learn, what cigarettes to smoke,
really?
What drinks to drink. He was very worried about the bands. He'd look after you, but he was a lovely man.
And were you still with him? Were you still with him? Was he still your manager when he died?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's weird, Dean. The night he died, the Beatles were in Bangor in North Wales, and I was at my home in Anglesey, North Wales. We were 10 miles apart, and we hadn't seen each other for ages because of touring. The night Brian died, we were just 10 miles from each other.
Amazing.
It's strange, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So, Jenny, where are you now? What's coming up next? You're on the still out on the road, as always.
Yes, I am. I'm off to Australia next month.
Right.
And then for a month, then I come back, then I'm going to Spain for a bit of sunshine.
Good.
On my little wee body. And then we do a tour called Jerry Cross the Mersey.
Excellent.
Which is my life story.
How's your lovely Mrs. Pauline?
She sends you her love.
Send her mine.
I will do.
As always. And Jenny, when are we going to see you back in Liverpool?
Working-wise, maybe March or April, something like that. No, not March, it is. Maybe April or May.
Okay. Well, listen, when you've...
It's not possible, Dean.
Well, when you're around, will you come in and, come and see me at the top of the tower?
I certainly will, and then we can go and have a little snifter.
Oh, indeed. And, well, I'm all in favour of that, and we'll have a proper conversation. Listen, many, many congratulations to everyone from City Talk on your honour. And as I say, it is long overdue. Lovely talking to you, as always, Jerry.
God bless you, Dean. Thank you. Take care of yourself.
This is The Sullivan Show.
The Sullivan Show.
On City Talk 105.9.
Up to 25 school crossing patrols could be axed in Liverpool, and the council plans to save money. The City Council wants to put unmanned crossings in place of the lollipop men or women who patrol the threatened sites outside some secondary schools. The news comes just a few months after a similar scheme to get rid of 18 posts was put forward in Wirral. Councillor Flo Clucas said the affected crossings would affect young adults rather than small children. She joins me on the line now. Who's actually made this decision,
Councillor? Well, can I firstly correct what you've said?
Yeah.
I have not said it will affect young adults rather than small children. And I think we need really to say exactly what the situation is, because the crossings are already in place. So what we have are 20 crossings which can be operated, which have a red light facility. In other words, traffic can be stopped by a red light. Those crossings are already in place outside 20 schools, and children are already using them. Indeed, adults already use them because they're a good deal safer than simply having somebody there for half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the afternoon.
Is it not the case, Flo, that lollipop men and lollipop women had a greater sense of security and safety to those crossings?
No, I don't think it is, because what they're effectively doing is standing there and pressing a button. And what we want is to have children safer 24 hours a day, not just for half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the evening.
But isn't that the busiest time when those crossings are being used on the way to school and coming from school?
No, not necessarily, and I'll explain why. Many of the children actually attend things like breakfast clubs, so they get there earlier than the time of the school crossing patrol. Many do out-of-school activities or evening activities, playing netball, football matches. They leave later than the school crossing patrol, so we have to ensure that those children are safe when they're crossing roads.
Yeah, but you can't argue that most of the children are going during those busy times, aren't they?
But those crossings are already there, and the child and the parent who is supposed to take the child to school actually have only to press a button and the traffic has to stop. It's illegal for it to carry on going. Now, we have had, in the last few years, a 50% reduction in the numbers of children who have been killed and injured on our roads because we've been putting these crossings in. They cost about £186,000 a time. And any money that we save from some of those crossing patrols, and there are some, in fact, which are not used at all, so I'll talk about those in a moment. The money we save from them is reinvested into the properly controlled crossings, pelican crossings, puffing crossings, red light crossings, because children are safer 24 hours a day, as indeed are adults. Some of those that are going from the service are lunchtime crossings, where actually the schools no longer have a lunchtime. Children stay on the premises, but we still have 25 of those where people attend, even though there are no children crossing. Doesn't make sense to me to have people there when there are no children there. So we will be withdrawing those, and quite right too. What we want to do is to make children safer, make adults safer, in fact, on our roads 24 hours a day, not just for half an hour in the morning and half an hour in the middle of the afternoon.
Do you not think that the old lollipop lady and the old lollipop man are going to be sorely missed? I mean, let's face it, honours list, there's usually one who gets an MBE or an OBE.
I think they have done
services to the community.
I think our lollipop ladies and our lollipop men have done a fantastic job. But what we're faced with now is a situation where drivers who use roads are travelling faster, where leaping out in front of a car that's coming towards you is not the safest thing to do. And indeed, because those lollipop ladies and men do that, I think they actually put children at risk because they actually pass on to...
Sorry to interrupt you. I've never, ever heard of a lollipop man or a lollipop woman leaping out in front of the traffic.
They do. They actually have to step out in front of...
I wouldn't have thought any of them had the wherewithal to do that. They're all pensioners, aren't they?
They step out into a road where there is oncoming traffic because that is how they put the traffic in a position where it has to stop, and they hold up their lollipop. Now, I think that asking people to do that is not the right way to teach children safety on the road.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Joining us now on the line with his take on President Bush, because, of course, we had 8 years of President Bush, is our very own John Bishop, a local comedian John Bishop. How are we, John?
All right, Dino, how are you?
Yeah, good. Are you going to miss George Bush? Did you used to use him in your act?
The thing was, he got battered by everybody, and he was a gift for the comedian, but a disaster for the world. So it was one of those things where you say, well, let's try and make some fun about the misery that he's creating. So I think in some respects, we're going to miss him. Because every comedian around the world was thinking, if Obama gets in, what can you say about him?
Yeah,
he's just a saint, isn't he? Everybody loves him. I was thinking, I hope somebody finds him in a brothel or something like that before the end of the election, so at least we'll have one joke.
Now, of course, Bush is famous for his gaffes, wasn't he?
The thing is, the gaffes that he used to say were so ridiculous, but he never seemed embarrassed by them. You never, ever saw him go, I made a mistake there. He just kept on doing them, didn't he? They were some crackers.
Do you think that was because he probably didn't know what he was talking about or didn't know what he was saying?
I think it's because nobody told him it was wrong.
Let's have a listen anyway. Let's have a listen to him. Here we go.
We need an energy bill that encourages consumption.
The United States of America is engaged in a war against a extremist group of folks.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Our enemies are innovative and resourceful. And so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we.
Tribal sovereignty means that. It's sovereign. You've been given sovereignty, and you're viewed as a sovereign entity.
Okay.
And therefore, the relationship between the federal government and tribes is one between sovereign entities.
If you don't stand for anything, you don't stand for anything. If you don't stand for something, you don't stand for anything.
I think tide turning, as I remember, I was raised in the desert, but tides kind of turn. It's easy to see a tide turn.
You know what, John? If you didn't laugh, you'd be terrified. This was the most powerful man in the world.
The mad thing, you know, this is what he speaks like after he gave up drinking. You know, he used to be an alcoholic, and some people suggest he had a cocaine addiction. Imagine what he was like then. I mean, this is sober.
It's amazing.
It's unbelievable. And the thing was, he was obviously not reading. You know, he was doing all that stuff about a sovereign nation.
Yeah,
and then
you
could tell he was, all of a sudden he got a word in his head and he couldn't get it out.
What about saying when he said about the human beings can coexist with fish?
Fish, I know. I know, but he's from Texas. They do a lot of strange things down in Texas.
Oh, they do. So you're going to miss him then, as he's, you know, he was there to be held up as a figure of fun, I suppose.
Oh, definitely. I'm going to miss him as a butt of jokes, but I think the world's a better place now that he's gone. And I think we're all full of anticipation about Obama, and I know, unfortunately, he probably can't live up to that. But all being well, when he stands up and says a speech, you're not going to get them same gaps.
No.
Not at all.
You're absolutely right. John, thanks for that.
Cheers, Gino.
That was our very own John Bishop with his take on President Bush. Historic day today, the 44th President of the United States to be sworn into office later this afternoon, 5 o'clock our time, the first black president to sit in the Oval Office. Coming up next is all your news and sports, of course, in the second hour. Dino's Dames are with us, and I'm also joined by Dr. James Kingsland, our resident doctor in the house. If you have a question for him, you can give us a call on the usual numbers. This is City Talk. 105.9, it's the voice of Liverpool across Merseyside, North Wales and the great North West.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Hello, how are you, Dean?
Very well indeed. Is the sun shining where you are?
Yes, it's lovely. And how is lovely Liverpool?
Oh, Liverpool is great. I'm looking forward to greeting you once again.
Well, it's always nice to talk to somebody in the old pool, you know.
Of course, you know, going way, way back, I think, to the 80s or whatever.
You know, long before that,
before
Dean.
That
I
even.
Am actually 61 now,
oh.
And I've been coming to Liverpool since the 1950s, since they had steam trains.
Oh.
Honestly, I kid you not. My dad was a Scot, but my mother's a Scouser, you see. So every
right.
summer holidays, every child in Scotland headed for the seaside, and I headed for Liverpool 8.
Well, do you know what, Barbara? I never realised that your mother was a Scouser.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I go back. And I mean, I've got real big connections, family connections with Liverpool 8. My Auntie Ivy lived in Carrington Street, which
right.
is just off Upper Pally.
Yes, of course.
And then, of course, my very good school friend Rosemary Gordon still lives in Waterloo.
Right.
And she was at Seafield Convent, and I became friendly with her when we were on a school trip together, age 14.
Wow.
Then I came to do John Paul George in 1970s.
Yeah.
Then I came back to do Blood Brothers. It goes on and on and on, and still happily is continuing to this day.
Well, Barbara, I was going to say you're regarded as an honorary Scouser, but I think you're a real Scouser, actually.
Well, I'm half Scouse, absolutely. Well, how do you think I managed to bring so much knowledge to Mrs. Johnson?
Absolutely. Wow. Well, tell us about that part. How did you first meet Willie Russell?
Well, I knew Willie long before either of us were well known at all. We met on the folk scene.
Right.
And for those of you who, you know, your listeners who have heard Willie talking about his interests in life, folk music is right up there,
as it
is with me. We're both very interested in traditional music. And Willie was in the folk movement, and he came up to Edinburgh. I think this was the first time I met him. He came up with St. Catherine's to do something at the festival, and I met him up there amongst in the pub, the folk pub that everybody used to go to called Sandy Bells. I met Willie there, and then, of course, I became friendly with him and Annie. And when I was in Liverpool, I used to come and stay with him. And Willie watched a show that I did at the Mitre. And that's what convinced him to ask me to do John Paul, George, Ringo and Bert and be the singer
right.
of the Beatles songs in that show. So we've been friends since about 1970.
And is that all you did in the show? You just sang the songs?
Sang all the songs and played the piano, and Bobby Ashe and Terry, who they were the other musicians, and we used to swap instruments, and they used to sing, but I did most of the singing, so I was on stage singing, but on a bandstand. That's the way that it was structured.
And that was at the Everyman Theatre?
At the Everyman, and then in London. It was whisked off to London by these very famous impresarios.
And of course, it was. It was a great piece, wasn't it?
It was a fantastic piece. I believe Willie keeps getting asked to revive it. But the premise of it was that the Beatles were all getting back together to do a concert
right.
at the Phil. And of course, because of what's happened historically, that can't happen. And whether Willie had ever thought of rewriting it, I don't know. But it was a fantastic show and was really quite original. You know, when you think about, there have been a lot of good things. But this is the thing about Willie. Willie. He doesn't write musicals like other people write musicals. It's a different thing with him. It's truly original.
Well, of course, you were the original, the definitive, I have to say, Mrs. Johnson, because I did see you in Liverpool when it first opened in Blood Brothers, of course. And, you know, it's testament to that show. It's still running today.
Well, it is bulletproof, I have to say. It's, as a piece of writing, it is as sound as any Shakespeare, really. It really does hang together. And people are so fundamentally drawn to the characters in that story. They do feel huge empathy with the people in the story. And I think it's because Willie based it on the sort of ancient tales and ballads, you know, that people would have sung to them 600-700 years ago. You know, a peddler would arrive and say, "Have you heard the latest story about Robin Hood?" Well, that's what Blood Brothers is. Blood Brothers, the narrator says, "Did you ever hear the story of the Johnson twins as like each other as two new pins?" And this is exactly, he tells them at the beginning what the end is, how they were born and they died on the selfsame day. So they know at the beginning what's going to happen, but they're drawn into the story and the story unfolds. And that is the power of Blood Brothers. It's entirely on the page.
Well, it's a Greek tragedy almost, isn't it?
It is. I believe it's based on what they call the Corsican Brothers story, and I don't know what that is. But Willie is, you know, hugely clever, and the lovely thing is he based this powerful story in Liverpool, which is, of course, what he knows about. He is a Liverpudlian. He's rooted in the city and its people. So it grew out of something quite remarkable.
And of course, Barbara, the wonderful thing about Blood Brothers is the audience, as you just said there, they know how the piece is going to end. And yet, as you said, you're drawn into it and you can't help but be moved so much when the ending does come.
Because it is so grim that it does come true. I mean, there is a chance, you know. Well, in the ancient tales, there was no chance that it would change. Yeah. I mean, it does prophesy that the narrator, you know, is... He is supposed to be sort of every man, really. He's not supposed to be the devil. And really, you have to believe that he knows what's going to happen. But the thing is, we all hope that it isn't, and that is what causes the shock, is that when it does happen, you think, oh, my God, it does happen. It is going to come true. And, of course, for the mother, the central figure of the mother, it's just... it's unbelievable.
And what's it like playing that part every night, the part of the mother? It must be draining.
It's such a long, long time, really, since the original production, which was so powerful in my life. It was fantastic. I mean, it had a lot of laughs and a lot of humour in it as well. Mm. But it was very difficult to do that final scene because I used to come running from the back of the room. And occasionally when we were in London, I would be stopped by some Jobsworth, you know, who worked in the theatre, who said, "Oh, you can't go in there, madam." And I'd say, "Get out of my way. I'm in the play, you cretin," you know. And he would think I was the cleaning lady who'd arrived, you know, to clean the theatre. "The audience is still in there, madam." "Yes, I know, because I'm in the play." And so occasionally things like that would happen. But generally speaking, it was the most powerful and wonderful. I mean, I became an actress at that time and I thought, oh, this is great. I can do Macbeth now. However, I never did. But there was a wonderful quality. I mean, Willie's writing is just superb. Mm. And that is what it is. You can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. I've got to tell you that I know it's an old-fashioned saying, but you really can't. You cannot make something good if it isn't good to begin with.
No, you need that. You need that material.
Well, you get what you're given, and if you're given a really poor piece of writing, it doesn't matter how good you are. You can give it to Derek Jacobi, and he would make nothing of it. But the thing is that if you have a good piece of work, you're helped massively. It's the same with music. If you've got fabulous music, you've got to be really poor to not to be able to impart it and give it to the audience as if it were a precious jewel.
You're absolutely right. Barbara, I'm talking to my special guest, Barbara Dixon. Barbara, you had the most remarkable career. How did it all start for you? How did you get into singing? Was it something you'd done from when you were a child?
Well, no, I wasn't in show business. I mean, don't get me wrong, I joined show business when I left the Everyman and went to London and got signed up by Robert Stigwood's record company.
Right.
But I wasn't in show business until then. I mean, I was really about 8-9 years as a professional musician and quite happily working in the folk music circuit when I became very, very well known and became a household name for 10 years. I was a pop star until the middle of the 80s.
Yeah.
So it kind of happened in decades for me. So from 1985, I've just kind of gone back to doing what I was doing before, which is discovering songs, singing songs. I write some songs. I don't write very much, but I'll think about doing my own stuff and delving into the realms of thoughtful, intimate music. That's where I think my strength has always lain, in being able to take a song with really good words. I mean, there are exceptions to that, and I will put my hands up. There are some songs that I've done which aren't very good, but are the ones that are good have an exceptional, long-lasting quality. And I think when I was a child, I just used to sing songs that I liked on the radio to myself. I played the piano and used to sing along to playing the piano in the house. I played the guitar, sang on my own, played with a couple of boys who lived down the road, went to the folk club and started performing in a very informal way. As anyone who's been to folk clubs will tell you, it's a very informal atmosphere and very encouraging of people who want to perform and haven't got loads of confidence. So it was a good way to start. And then I was plummeted from being a folk musician into being a pop star in the middle of the 70s.
Now, folk music and Celtic music is very important to you, isn't it?
It is,
yes. Is that your roots, Barbara?
Yes, it is, yeah. Yes, it's the music that, when I was about 12, I started to get very, very interested in this music. I did love the Beatles and the Everly Brothers, and I liked, you know, the pop music that all my peers liked as well as a teenager in the 60s. But my heart absolutely connected to folk music. I love folk music, and it's a bit like a virus. It kind of lives in your spine forever, and it doesn't ever go away. So occasionally I'll bump into Willie at the Folk Awards in London, and the pair of us will have a chin wag, and he's been invited, and he wouldn't dream of not going if he can. And the same as me. I'm on tour, and I'm going to go on a night off.
But what is it about that particular music, Barbara, that stirs you emotionally?
It's interesting. I talked to my friend Troy Donnelly, who I work with, about this, and I said, what is it about this music? Why does it make me just react the way it does? It's absolutely different fundamentally to popular music. It has so much more depth than popular music. And I said, what is it? What is it about it? And he said, I don't know what it is. He said, but you absolutely respond to it the way he does as well. He says, it's a bit like folk music, and the appreciation of it is a bit like the word Blackpool in the stick of Blackpool Rock. It's right through the middle of you, and you react because it's like a gut reaction. You've not been taught to like it. You like it from sort of some kind of memory that you have, and it's a lot of the songs have got wonderful stories. They're very important stories. They talk about, you know, the life in the raw. And this is why I also like drama that has some kind of grittiness to it as well.
But you're talking there about a memory. It's almost as if you're born with it.
Yes, well, I know that sounds slightly hippie, but I do believe there is a degree of that. I've got a quality in my performance which I know the people of Liverpool really appreciate as well. And it has a kind of sadness and a vulnerability.
Mm.
And it comes out of a whole pile of stuff. And so it lends itself to singing songs that have a poignancy to them. That's why, you know, when I did sing Tell Me It's Not True, or I sang Easy Terms to people, and I continue to sing Easy Terms in my shows to people, people are very, very moved by it. And it's not me being clever. It's something I just have that has come through again. It's come through my personality.
Yeah, also as well, Barbara, as you've said, it's not just the words and it's not just the music. There's something else there as well.
Yeah, in the old days we would have called it the X Factor, but we don't call that anymore. But it's something that you possess that gives you total originality, that makes you unlike anybody else, and you do not come off a production line being able to do that. It's like you can't teach people to act. You can send them to drama school. You can teach them technique, but you can't make them act like Andrew Schofield.
That's right, absolutely
he
right.
He has never been to drama school, and he's one of the best actors I've ever met.
Absolutely.
Because he has an innate sensitivity towards what he's saying and a respect for the other people on the stage. And that all goes together with what we used to call raw talent.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I totally agree with you, Barbara. You know, I've said this on many occasions. You cannot teach somebody how to act. You cannot. You either have that ability, that innate sense. And it's the same with performing. The way you perform as well, you've got that without, you know, in spades.
Well, in a lot of cases nowadays, people are surrounded by production, and therefore it doesn't really matter because you can't really see whether they can or they can't do it, because they're maybe singing songs that everybody knows, so the audience isn't critical, and also that they're surrounded by so much production, so many lights, so many musicians, so much sound, that the point is almost lost. But if you take an artist like James Taylor, who walks onto the stage with the guitar and starts to sing "Just Yesterday Morning They Let Me Know You Were Gone," you know it's the opening bars of Fire and Rain, and James Taylor is standing there on his own. He is the inimitable James Taylor. There's nobody like him in the world.
Barbara, I remember seeing Tony Bennett in concert in Liverpool, interestingly enough, at the Philharmonic Hall, where you're coming to, and he ended his show by actually putting the mic down and singing unaccompanied, and filled that whole arena with his most wonderful voice, without any production, without any microphone, without any backing.
Well, that is fantastic. And, of course, us folk singers, we sing unaccompanied all the time. And we can't understand why people come up and say, "Wow, that was amazing. How can you sing without accompaniment?" And I said, actually, it's kind of easier to sing without accompaniment, because then you can't go wrong, you know, because you're just singing away. Yeah, that's the sort of thing. I mean, that's a unique experience. And there's not many artists. I mean, there are people who have wonderful sound in their voice, like Michael McDonald or like Paul Carrack or Bonnie Raitt, who don't sound like anybody else. And I know that I'm older, and I'm not speaking for people in their 20s, and probably the people listening would not understand what I'm talking about, but older people will. They'll know exactly what I mean, that they would like to go and see somebody who is unique in some way, and I believe that I am, not because I'm so clever that it, you know, everyone's going to say, "Wasn't she smart?" It's because I've got a gift, I think. I really do. I used to stumble over saying that to people. I used to think, "Oh dear, that sounds really eggy," but I think I do have a gift. I think I've just got it from somewhere. Could be from my Scouse mother and my Scottish father. It could be in my DNA, and it's something to do with the vulnerability and lack of confidence I had as a younger person. And all these things make you into a good performer if you have a very good instrument. And I think it's a combination of things, don't you?
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And you talk about having a gift. How do you look? Do you look after that gift? How do you look after that gift?
No, I don't. I don't protect it, because I think if you overprotect things, sometimes they can go more wrong. And what I do is I do a vocal warm-up every day while I'm on stage. I'm doing vocal warm-ups already, pardon me, because I start my rehearsals at the weekend.
Right.
So by the time I get to Liverpool, I will be doing a vocal warm-up every day. And I will have done a show the day before. So I will be, you know, I'll be sort of, so hopefully up to speed, because I will have been in the south of England the day before and travelled up to Liverpool for the show at the Phil.
You'll be in fine voice. Barbara, do you like touring? Do you like being on the road?
I do. I love it.
Is that the gypsy in you?
I do love it. I mean, it's a very... it's a very strange thing. I think it is quite tiring, but my goodness, I do protect myself physically. I mean, I was talking about my voice there, but I always have a rest in the afternoon, and I don't talk to anybody, and I won't do any interviews in the afternoon because I really do feel that I need to rest, and then I get up and I sort of hit the ground running, so I have the energy and the pace and the focus to do the show in the evening. Now, if I observe those rules, then I'm in very good form and I do enjoy it immensely. And of course, coming to Liverpool is, I certainly don't say it everywhere, it is a unique experience. Sometimes I just walk out of that door, stage left on the fill, which, no, it's like a normal door. It's not like a proscenium arch theatre. It's a platform stage. And I just, they open the door for me and I just walk out. And I just, it's just like being, you know, in some kind of great big vat of love.
Do you feel like you're coming home, Barbara?
It is really fantastic. It is what they call palpable. You know, there is a feeling that sometimes I think, oh, my God, I hope I can live up to this. Because there is an expectation. It's not a negative thing, but there is an expectation. Oh, here's Barbara Dixon again, and we love her, and I love them. And it's terrible because you stand there thinking, oh, God, I hope I can be as good as they need me to be. But, of course, it's not a critical. They're not daring me to do it.
Can we look forward to any new songs in this show?
Yes, yeah. I've got some new songs. I've got a couple of absolute brand new ones. Right. I'm not going to tell you what they are at the very, very beginning. And then, of course, I'll be doing things like Caravans and Another Suitcase and I Know Him So Well that people would expect me to do. And Answer Me, which I've put back into my set, which was my first
hit. I love that song.
Isn't it beautiful? Yeah. And one of my children had never heard me sing it before, my 20-year-old son, Gabriel. Mm. And he absolutely loved it. He saw it last year and he said, I love that song. So there we are.
Barbara, I look forward to it. I'm going to be there. I'll be in the audience.
Wonderful.
I'll see you afterwards as well.
You say hello to me, won't you?
Of course I will. We will welcome you with open arms, as always, Barbara Dixon.
Oh, that's so sweet. Thank you very much. Little,
and as always, a great pleasure talking to you, Barbara.
Thank you.
God bless.
The Sullivan Show on City Talk 105.9.
Now, more than one third of employees have changed their accent in order to impress their boss and improve their career prospects. So, new research suggests. More than 1,000 people surveyed, 38% of those with a regional accent said that they had difficulties being understood. The Queen's English came out top in terms of being the easiest to understand and the most professional. Joining me now from publicimage.co.uk is expert on etiquette, Diana Mathers. Good afternoon, Diana.
Good afternoon, Dean.
Do you think it's important, say in a job interview, to be able to speak correctly and to be understood?
The most important thing is to be understood. I mean, accents are not as important as they were, and if you say the lack of accent is not as important as it was a few years ago, but what is really important is diction, clear speech, because if people can't understand easily, they switch off. And especially if jobs are going to be over the telephone, then you do need clear speech, which means finishing off words. Now, Liverpool accent is a great accent, but, you know, you can see they're awfully fast, and it's quite difficult for people who come south of Watford to understand the words you're saying. So
that was very good.
even with a Liverpool accent, then, as long as you slow down and actually finish the words that you're speaking, people can understand. So it's not so much a matter of changing the accent, but making the speech clear, which means finishing words and not using things like gonna, gotta, going to, got a, is much more acceptable.
I think you're absolutely right. I used to give advice to young people who worked with me on Brookside and said, you know, the secret of playing a good Liverpudlian on TV was not to be perfectly authentic and genuine, but to be understood. You can still have a Liverpudlian accent, but you must be understood.
Absolutely right. And that, as I say, means slowing down and finishing the words. And the trouble is that we are not taught at all today to actually speak clearly. And, you know, your tongue is a muscle like any other. And that's why we teach people tongue twisters and speech exercises, so you take your mouth to the gym so you can actually speak clearly, because otherwise you can't suddenly expect your tongue to behave in a way that it doesn't behave the normal rather 24 hours of the day, you know.
So Diana, what sort of exercises would you advise?
Well, there are two ones which are really, really good. One is red leather, yellow leather, red lorry, yellow lorry, and to say that really, really fast. And the other is Peggy Babcock. Peggy Babcock. Babcock. Peggy, I can't even say it. Really fast as well. Because that not only helps your mouth, but it also makes you think about what you're saying. And when we get people to read them, because they are actually, the exercises are done to really help, if you like, all the mouth really exercise itself. But some of them are very silly, and people read what they expect to see, not what they are actually seeing. And again, that can be so important for some jobs and some job interviews.
Are there any accents in particular that people are in favour of, that actually go in their favour, say, at job interviews?
Well, the Irish accent is always wonderful, because the voice is very soft, and, you know, everyone feels that they're very sympathetic, which they are. I'm half Irish myself, whereas the Northern Irish are very different indeed, and that's quite a different accent, and that is not half so popular. As I'm afraid, the Liverpool accent is not one of the most favoured ones either, although I love it myself.
Yeah, Liverpool, Mancunian and Midlands come bottom, don't they, usually?
Well, that's right, because you see that the Mancunian, the real Mancunian accent, again, right down the back on the throat, like that, on the throat, on the throat, because again, they don't finish the words and they just swallow it. Whereas it's got to come forward at the front of your mouth, and you have to make sure that you do finish the words. But the most important thing is to tape record yourself and listen to your own voice.
Don't you find that most people, when they do listen to a playback, if they're caught accidentally on tape or whatever, and they listen to their own voices, don't you find that most people go, that doesn't sound like me at all?
Exactly. And most people hate their own voices. Mm. I don't know of anyone who does like their own voice, but you have to get to know it. It's our greatest instrument of communication.
Well, of course, being an actor, I do know my own voice, and I know the importance of it, especially now working in radio. What sort of tips could you give, Diana, to anybody who may be going along for a job interview and is feeling a little bit nervous, wants to put them over in the best possible light?
What they must remember is that we make up 90% of our minds about something within the first 5 to 10 seconds. So the way they walk into the room, with a smile, head held high, looking both interesting and interested, then that is one thing to remember. To sit down, listening skills, eye contact, and remember to think about your diction. So, you know, you're not just flopping about like that, because people with very sloppy diction, you know, it's not going to come across in the way. So even if you've got a strong accent, if you finish, the T's and the D's are really important.
And finally, Diana, is etiquette still important today?
Very much so, and in fact becoming more so. And I think that, you know, a little charm can go a long, long way. And we always say that social skills build business, because people buy from people.
Absolutely. And I always say, you know, people, no matter who they are always impressed with manners.
They are. If you just think about somebody else, good manners are treating other people with kindness, consideration and respect. And if we all did that, the world would be a nicer place, wouldn't it?
Indeed it would. Diana, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Dean.
That's Diana Mathers from publicimage.co.uk.
The Sullivan Show.
Weekday afternoons, 1 till 4.
On City Talk 105.9.
Listen, and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.